I want to welcome everyone here today. I've had a chance to talk for a while with Stephen Green, and you're in for a real treat. I'm E.J. Dionne. I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings. And I have to say that when this project first came up, I was very happy to do it because I was intrigued at the idea of the president of one of the largest banks in the world who was also an ordained Anglican minister. But I came at the project with what I would call open-minded skepticism, because after what we've been through in the last 2 years, I was wondering whether I really wanted to spend a lot of time learning what a banker, the president of a rather big bank, had to teach us about morality. It sounded a bit like a Stephen Colbert segment. And then I started reading the book, and I have to say that Stephen Green is a great person to go on a moral and intellectual journey with. He's actually a good person to go on a geographical journey with. He writes about globalization, and he knows the globe. There are also just wonderful things you learn in this book that are those facts you can use at a dinner party or a bar argument. I certainly didn't know that the Earth's population has gone from 10 million to more than 6 billion in the last 10,000 years. I did not know that for 18 of the past 20 centuries, China has been the world's largest economy. How many of you know the word, and tell me if I pronounce this right, Zappozaps? Is that close enough?
Yeah, I think so.
Anybody ever hear of a Zappozap? You will win your next game of Scrabble just by coming to this event. A Zappozap is a decorated axe. And it was one of the earliest objects of global trade around the time of Hammurabi in 1800 B.C. And then much more ominously, I learned that the estimates are wide, but between 12 and 27 million people right now are in, around the world are working in conditions that amount to slavery. And this book is full of observations like that. It's also full of literary references that I think Stephen will talk about. I want to introduce him first. He was born in England in November 1948. He has degrees from Oxford University and from MIT. His first career was as a civil servant. Well, actually, his very first job was working in a program for alcoholics where he met his wife, who was also working in that program. So Joy, yes, I want to emphasize that we're working in that program, helping other people. Joy, where are you? It's so good to have you with us. And then he went to work for the government. So you could say he was a government bureaucrat, which endeared him to me, I have to say. He began his career with the British government's Ministry of Overseas Development. He joined McKinsey in 1977, the Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation in 1982. He became CEO in 2003. Is that, am I correct about that? And then chairman in 2006. He's also the chairman of the British Bankers Association, a member of the Prime Minister's Business Council, and a trustee of the British Museum. And he and his wife, Joy, have two daughters. But I was very fascinated that in the middle of this banking career, Stephen Green decided to become an ordained Anglican priest. And I wanted to ask him, because it turns out to be very important to this story. You don't fully learn it at the end, although you get a hint when you see that he sees Teilhard or Chardin, not Marx or Adam Smith, as the real prophet of globalization. But you don't really learn it till the last chapter. This is not a typical banker's career move. Might you tell people hear a little bit about that decision and what that might tell them about who you are?
Well, EJ, thank you. Can I say, to start with, what a pleasure it is to be here. But to the point, it's worth just a 5 seconds of background. In the Anglican Church in England, there is quite a well-established career path, well, career is maybe the wrong word, of people who stay in secular careers of one sort or another, who put them put themselves forward for ordained ministry, ordained priesthood. So what I was doing may be unusual for a chairman of a bank, but it's not particularly unusual within the context of the Anglican Church. And there are, in fact, about 10% of the ordained clergy in England follow another career as well and get paid by that career rather than by the church. which is the case in my case. When I left university, I did think about a full-time ministry in the church for various reasons that I don't need to bore you with. I think that it was the right call not to do it at that point. And then in my 30s, this started to bubble up again, and so I put myself forward on that basis, specifically on that basis, i.e. staying in my secular banking career. Did my night school stuff, which you had to do to get the training and the accreditation, and that's worked out.
And your first book was called after you were ordained, correct?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The first book was called.
It was a book that I wrote in the mid '90s, so a while back now. It was called "Serving God?" Serving Mammon? Mammon being the biblical word for money, and it was specifically designed to answer the question for a Christian. Can I meaningfully say that I've got a sense of vocation and be a banker? And I wrote that now 15 years ago. It's a small book. It's out of print. It's out of date. I don't think I would change the basic answer, which is yes, with some rather important caveats and conditions.
And caveats and conditions are a very important part of this book. Before I ask some specific questions, I'd like to give you a chance to talk about this book as you see it. Basically, why did you feel a need, desire, compulsion, inspiration, obligation to write this particular book?
Well, I received a fair amount of encouragement from friends who knew that I'd written that previous book and said, it's time you did something. And I have to say, I enjoyed doing it. I enjoy writing. And I wanted to pull together some thoughts that had been kind of developing over the years. Thoughts that are not just about banking. It is plainly not a book about banking, and nor is it a book about the financial crisis, though it does spend one chapter talking about financial crises. It's a book about globalization. And I suppose what prompted that was the result of the huge privilege I have of sitting in the job that I sit in is that I see a lot of the world. I travel a great deal. The bank that I work with operates in 85 countries, so I see almost every imaginable community culture at work, and I see the very strong sense in which the world is becoming more and more of a crossroads, the way in which globalization is proceeding. And I wanted to reflect on the implications of that, because I think they're very deep, very profound, very long-standing. I don't think that globalization is a new phenomenon. To your introductory remarks, I think it starts in the beginnings of human history. It is the great sweep of human history, not without bumps and diversions on the road, but nonetheless the great sweep of human history. Allied to it is the equally important phenomenon of urbanization. Last year, 2008, was the year in which we passed the point where more than half of the people of the world live in cities. And by the year 2050, that'll be something like 80% of the population of the world lives in cities. This is changing the way humans interact with each other. It's changing the way humans think about themselves and each other. And I just wanted to spend some time exploring the implications of all of that in the book. So that's what I did.
I told you earlier today that I thought you'd make an excellent politician, because I picked up my Wall Street Journal opinion page on Saturday, and there was a long interview with Stephen Green praising him as a Churchillian defender of capitalism. And then I read the book, and my views did not match those of the Wall Street Journal editorial page, and I read it as including an awful lot of caveats about capitalism. And in some sense, both accounts are right. The Churchillian defense, by the way, in this case, is not "we will fight on the beaches." It's from Churchill's great line about democracy. It's the worst form of government except for all the others. But your book also includes a lot of doubts about the way capitalism works. So I'll just quote a couple of passages. So it is not surprising that the financial markets and their waywardness have caused intense and widespread anger, or that we ask ourselves if globalization is allowing them to get completely out of hand. It is not surprising that we ask whether they will eventually blow up in a way which permanently damages economic and social well-being, or that we ask why should ordinary people suffer from all of this destructive excess. For years, the West enjoyed what was called the Goldilocks economy. It was called this because it was deemed, so to speak, to be neither too hot nor too cold, but just right, though the connotations of its being a fairy tale later turned out to be relevant to. And then just one last line from the book, and this is the Anglican priest thundering from his pulpit. "The sins of arrogance, greed, untrustworthiness, and callousness are hard to forgive. The perception that some have taken pay and bonuses in vast multiples of the remuneration of ordinary, hardworking, and socially valuable people for indulging in an alchemy which has then blown up in their faces and required huge bailouts at prodigious cost to taxpayers has ignited fury around the world." So you here offer a bold defense of capitalism and then a rather searing criticism of how it operated. Can you sort of bring those together for us?
Well, I can.
And does it mean you're an excellent politician?
I hope it doesn't mean I'm an excellent politician. But I think the point to start with is this Churchillian defense. And as you rightly said, this is not about defending it on the beaches and all the rest of it. This is about recognizing, in parallel to what Churchill said about democracy, that it's the worst system except for all of the others that have been tried from time to time. And it seems to me that the stark lesson of the 20th century, when these other alternatives were tried, is just how appalling they were. That therefore means that there is no alternative but to look at the markets in the face, see what they have done, see what they've achieved positively, see how they have failed humanity in very important ways, particularly recently, learn the lessons and find a better way forward. There is no turning the clock back. You cannot go back to a more simple, less connected world than the one we're in. In fact, the process of globalization and all that goes with that will continue.
But do you think, you know, in your book you talk about how the world was globalizing in the 19th century, and that the onset of World War I and the long period after that, the Great Depression, really did for a moment bring globalization to a halt and to some degree reversed it. Why isn't that possible again?
Well, I think it might be possible, but it would be one of our worst nightmares if it were realized. The reason why globalization came to a halt in 1914 was first of all the horrors of the First World War, and then secondly the rise of one of the major alternatives to the markets, which was tried out, of course, in the Soviet Union, and for a while looked as though it might take the world by storm. We now know what a hollow achievement it was and at what terrible human cost it was achieved. So I don't think anybody would be saying back to that. So we certainly have to find our way forward. There is no guarantee of success. And you could construct apocalyptic scenarios where something happens of a nature which is so terrible that it just forces human connectivity to undo itself and back to some simpler and much less attractive world. It really isn't what we would want to happen. And I also don't think it is what will happen. I think the best assumption is that the broad process of increasing connectivity in this world is very hard to reverse now.
When I was reading along about what you said about globalization, at some level, it's almost impossible to deny your core argument, given what's happened with communication, transportation, that we could withdraw into a different kind of world. And yet, it also occurred to me that, in fact, a very small percentage of the people on the planet, and they are mostly members of financial or business or government or intellectual elites, can actually be said to live in a global world. Most other people in the world, while they touch that world in many ways, live lives in their localities, in their nations. What do you make of this disconnect? Because I think it's one of the causes of the discontents that people feel with globalization. I would say legitimate discontents.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a whole subject about the extent to which elites get disconnected from the broader groupings in human society. But just before I come back to that, it's worth noting that much broader groupings in human society have been much more profoundly changed by globalization than merely, to use your phrase, touched by it. If you think back 50 years ago or 100 years ago, go back to 100 years ago, most people never went more than 100 miles from where they were born. That has now profoundly changed. Again, 100 years ago, most people had no information, no hard information about other societies, so all kinds of silly and often terrible prejudices were formed in people's minds about each other. I mean, I'm a European. We all know what Europe was like 100 years ago. Extensive prejudices about each other that were were the thing that the politicians were able to tap into as they launched the First World War. I actually don't think one of the great signs of human progress, just specifically speaking as a European for the moment, is that a war within the context of mainland Europe is, I would say, no longer thinkable. You simply cannot imagine that even if some fanatic took over one of the countries, they could mobilise opinion to support the sort of aggression that Europe has known not merely in the last 100 years, but actually in the last 800 years or more. So I do think that we've come a long way. It may well be true that we've got a long way to go still, but I do think we've come a long way, and this is a process of change. I think the process of change is itself accelerating, no question, and causing all kinds of strains and stresses. And one of them is that you've got elites in the world who live like there really was a, to use the Thomas Friedman phrase, you know, a flat earth, a globalized world of society and economy, and actually the vast bulk of people live in more restricted lives. And that disconnect is something that is worth musing on, not that I do it too much in the book, but you and I talked about this morning, in the context of the thinking about the future of democracy.
Right, and, well, I was going to go somewhere else, but let me take it there, because I was struck that the words democracy and citizenship barely appear in your book, and that in the Global Bazaar, that's the word Stephen Green uses, in the Global Bazaar you describe there are investors and there are consumers and there are workers and there are professionals, but it doesn't feel like there are citizens. What is the role of citizens in this world? What is the role of democracy in such a world?
Yeah, and I think those are big questions. I think they're different ones, by the way. Citizenship is, I mean, you're right, it's not a word I use much, but I think that's a matter of terminology. What I do talk about, and I think is very important, is the question of loyalties to different groupings. You know, and I look at myself, as you mentioned, born in England, born in a particular town in England to which I feel like I belong, and where I might well want to go back to, because it's getting near the end. I'm also, am I English or am I British? That's a question I sometimes muse on, and it's a very particular British problem. What is the national identity? I am a European, and I am in some senses too a citizen of the broader world. And the growing consciousness that we have shared issues, notably the climate, environment, etc., that we can't solve in any other way than globally, gradually, and it's gradually and fitfully, is introducing a sense of global citizenship amongst many of us, I would suggest. So the point is that citizenship is itself multi-layered and quite complex and certainly shifting over time.
There are philosophers who've argued that when you go back in some ways to Smith or Mill or Locke, they took political man and turned him into economic man. And that one of the net effects of small L liberalism, that is to say, free market liberalism, was to diminish the importance of politics in public life. Could you talk about that?
Well, I am not sure that I do think it has diminished the importance of politics. It's certainly complicated politics, because liberalism is, with the small L, is one way of describing the fundamental cause. I think urbanization is the primary, I'm going to say culprit, but I think it's the wrong word to use, cause of this. Urbanization has as its effect, sooner or later, that people more and more think as individuals as opposed to defining themselves automatically as members of groups. They may, in fact, continue to have associations. They may have all kinds of layers of association. Some of those may be global. Some of these may be connected via the internet. There are all sorts of ways it can happen. But the fundamental truth is that people are more and more thinking as individuals. That certainly complicates the lives of political movements. And indeed, it is not true everywhere yet, but it is certainly true in a place like Europe, that it is hard to imagine major mass movements of unthinking loyalty to some political creed of the kind that we did know in the 1930s.
How do you explain certain forms of extremism in the world, then, religious extremism?
Well, as I say, I don't think this is true everywhere yet. But it's clear from my use of the word yet that I do think that is the direction of travel. But it may well take generations to get there. I mean, we are only talking, all that we've said applies to, let's say, the last, at the outside, the last 200 years, maybe even the last 100 years, effectively, may even be since the war, as to the real extent of the change, in the context of human civilization that is, what do you want to say, 2,000, 5,000 or 10,000 years old. So this is new stuff. And to say that we have arrived at the end game at the moment would be obvious nonsense. I think this is more generations to come. But I do think the fundamental direction of travel is clear.
As a priest banker, do you see these forces of both globalization, urbanization, as leading to secularization?
It depends what you mean by secularization. If you mean by that people will have more and more a sense that it's their private decision what they believe, what values they hold, other than when they impinge on somebody else, and that there's a public domain that confines itself to relationships that can, in the limit, become purely commercial relationships, then yes, I think secularism is going to continue to spread through humanity. But it will be at different paces and is probably subject to some reversals, yes. And it is very questionable. I don't want to talk about this as though I think this is an unambiguous good. My contention mainly is that this is a phenomenon, not that it's something you necessarily want to see. But I do think secularization is going to spread.
How do you respond to that as a clergy person, as a Christian? I was thinking that some of your forebears, many forebears of Americans, went to China to convert people into Christians, and in a sense you went to convert them into capitalists. How do you respond to that yourself?
Well, I tell you what, I think as the world does get more and more interconnected, so people are discovering more and more about what other people think and believe, recognizing in almost succeeding breaths the interesting differences and the interesting commonalities that there are, and at its best, enriching themselves thereby. The conversation with people from different cultures, different traditions, different environments is an enriching one at its best. At its worst, of course, it can be a source of great tension and hatred and envy.
I want to bring everyone into this conversation. I could go on like this for about 2 hours, but I won't. I just want to sort of put a couple more questions to you before I go to the audience. It seems to me that in terms of justice, the core problem of globalization is that capital is far more mobile than labor. It can move much more quickly than labor can, which ends up putting individual workers at a comparative disadvantage. And that if you look at the impact of globalization on the rich countries, it seems to me that it's been especially harmful to the least advantaged people in the wealthiest countries, and that is what leads to a not at all irrational backlash against it. Could you talk about that? First of all, do you agree with my definition of the problem, and how do you look at it?
No, I think that is definitely an aspect of globalization. It is no coincidence, I think, that the divide between the income of the richest and the poorest has widened actually in almost every country in the last 20 years. That is partly the result of globalization. It is partly the result of the mobility of capital you have described. There are particular challenges in all of this, of course, that the jobs that get lost in the wealthy countries are jobs that get created in the poorer ones. And the other side of this coin is that the last 20 years have seen literally hundreds of millions of people raised out of abject poverty in some of the poorest countries of the world. So weighing this up and deciding what the right policy prescriptions are in the richer countries to help those who have been hurt most by the process is a real political challenge. What you can't do is get off the boat. What you can't do is not be part of this globalized era, because it is also true for the richer countries that they have gained in terms of consumption enormously by the process of globalization. So it will be very difficult for any group of citizens to say, I'd actually like to vote to get out of all of this.
Right, but I think that we have met very badly the challenge of what it means to create much higher levels of inequality within the relatively wealthy countries, and we've done very badly by an awful lot of the people who once could count on a decent standard of living based on manual labor in a way that they cannot anymore.
I quite agree, and I think this is a major social challenge in, and I would think, almost every G7 country, certainly in yours, certainly in mine.
One other aspect of inequality I wanted to talk about. You are quite critical at various moments of people in your profession, even as you defend it, as producing social goods.
Most of the time.
And when you look at the sort of change in the rewards, where the rewards to the very successful are much higher than they used to be, we've rewarded the winners more and punished the non-winners more. How much of that, you talk in the book defending a high compensation in your industry as a fight for talent, and yet it's always struck me that we've changed our ethic in terms of compensation in corporations, that the differentials that between CEOs and average workers have gone up, and that we accept a level of difference that we didn't used to. And that strikes me not as a market outcome, but a choice, an outcome of choice, a morality, a political outcome in a way. Do you share that?
I don't think I did defend that, and I certainly didn't defend the kind of compensation that was being paid in the banking industry in recent years. I mean, just to talk specifically about the banking industry for a moment, any reasonable inspection of what was going on in the go-go years in the first part of this decade would say that the market was distorted. And when a market's distorted, you get results that are not socially correct, if I can use that phrase. And there is work to be done to address that issue. I think more broadly, there's clearly a social issue that arises from the fact that we've just been discussing, namely not just in that industry, but across commerce generally. You've seen a widening out of the gap between the richest and the poorest members of communities. That's, I think, a big social issue in all of the G7 countries and has to be addressed. Or there will be rising tension, there may well be protectionism, and the net disbenefit of that for all of us is something we need to resist at all possible costs. So there is work to be done in this. What I do say in the book, and I do believe to be true, is that however much we learn the lessons and however much we repair the markets and remove distortions, I am enough of a believer in the markets to believe that they are the best engine of social and economic development, except for all of the others, the Churchillian defense, and we need to work with the grain of the markets and not against them. You need to make sure the markets are effective, and there's a lot of work to be done on that. You will, at the end of the day, have discrepancies between what people are paid. You will not get to a result where everybody's paid the same. Egalitarianism is a most unlikely outcome. So you are left with a question, which is a matter of degree. There comes a point where the discrepancy is so wide that it just feels socially uncomfortable. I think we're at that point in many countries in the world, like I say, both yours and mine. Even if we get it right, you'll still have a certain amount of discrepancy. You will still have uncomfortable differentials between, let's say, the pay of a CEO and the pay of the head of a major inner city school doing obviously valuable social work. Is that fair? Hard to defend. So you're left with a challenge, which is a challenge both socially and importantly also a challenge for the individual. And this actually does take you into some, what you might describe as religious considerations. The challenge to the individual, those to whom much is given, much is required of. And we talk a lot in the textbooks about corporate social responsibility. Well, I think there's a real sense in which there's an individual social responsibility on the part of those who happen to find themselves in that position for whatever reason. And that's an uncomfortable challenge which is not talked about enough and which is often not faced up to by the individual. I do go on to argue in the book that the more people do face up to that challenge and respond to it, the more real satisfaction they will have, as well as, I believe, the common good being enhanced.
There are two words in your, if you will, the spiritual chapter at the end, which I liked very much. There are two words you highlight, and I'd just like you to talk about what they mean to you, how you would define them. One is integrity, and the other is completeness.
They're an interesting pair of words. Integrity, at one level, has the obvious set of meanings. Integrity in your behavior, in your trustworthiness, in your integrity vis-a-vis the rules, paying taxes and all the rest of it. There's another sense, of integrity, where completeness is a substitute word. There's a sense in which what the markets have done to us in the last couple of decades is to force us or encourage us to compartmentalize our lives. That is, to set up our work life and run it according to one set of rules, and our other realms of life, family life, social life, according to different sets of rules. It's as if, and I think a phrase we haven't yet used, but I think it characterizes the last couple of decades, market fundamentalism, which has prevailed in the last couple of days, a couple of decades, has led to an attitude in work life all too often, and I think this is true of the banking industry as well, but not only the banking industry, where it's almost as if you were saying, if there's a market and I've got a product and a contract and it's legal, I don't have to ask any other questions about suitability or fairness or rightness. So it's a way, what you might say is, therefore, we've allowed that realm of life to be run by a set of rules where questions of rightness and suitability have been banished, yet you wouldn't accept that as a reasonable way of running your private life or your social life. I believe that that kind of compartmentalization of life is in the end spiritually damaging to the individual, quite apart from its effect socially. And that therefore there's a real sense in which integrity is about finding completeness of life, which is about making sure that you've got a holistic approach to life, and in particular about making sure you run your various different types of relationship, if you will, by the same set of rules instead of different ones.
I was struck by two sentences in the book that made me think this is a very, not a typical banker thought. You write, what has no value is valueless. What has immense value is priceless. And you also write, at the core of our discomfort is the commercialization of everything. You've sort of talked about that. I'd just like to push you a little more.
That phrase, which came, I was sitting in the bath when that occurred to me, and I think it kind of does encapsulate the point. You talk about things being priceless because they're of immense value. Either we all know in our lives that there are certain things you can't put a price on. They have such huge value to you, and they tend to be things like relationships, of course. We also know that something that is valueless can often still have a price on it. So what that tells us, there's a disconnect between what the commercialized or market fundamentalist view of the world that I've just been mentioning, the signals that sends to us, and what we know to be true in our inner being. And that's another way of describing the compartmentalization that has occurred.
Because I was,
it is not true that everything in worth life has got a that's worth, everything worthwhile in life has got a price. That's not true.
Yeah, I decided that the most fundamental market imperfection is captured by that sentence. What has immense value is priceless, because it can't be measured. Just because we both like this word so much, I can't resist asking, why is hope different from optimism? Hope is a very important theme at the end of your book, and in a sense throughout the book. And I'd like you, this is again, I'm calling upon you to be the Reverend Stephen Green.
Oh, I perish the thought. I mean, that last chapter does kind of get more explicitly my sense of understanding of what's going on from a specifically Christian religious perspective. And I think there are three themes that I think are important. I mean, they're not unique. I mean, there are plenty of people who could subscribe to this, but they matter to me. One is that there's a real sense in which the most important lesson of all human history, large and small, is that we're imperfect beings. As the way I put it, there's original grace and original sin, to use good Catholic terminology. And that's something that understanding of the nature of human reality should pervade all our understanding of everything that happens. You're constantly wanting to say about the markets, about all kinds of things, at their best, dot, 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 at their worst, dot, 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 and you see both kinds of things unfolding in human experience, point number one. Point number two, we don't know how this will all play out. I do believe that globalization is both a phenomenon rather than an ideology. It's a very long-standing and it's irreversible. We don't know whether this will take us into some kind of utopia, some kind of New Jerusalem on the one hand, or some awful apocalypse on the other. And that ambiguity is reflected in so much religious experience, actually, religious writings. And again, I think it's simply reflecting what we all think most of the time. We really don't know where all this heads. Does this head into some great debacle caused by climate change? Does it head into some great catastrophe born of nuclear proliferation? Or does it lead to a genuinely happier, integrated global community? Don't know. And Nick, despite that uncertainty, despite the previous sense that humans are capable of the best and the worst, there is the third point, which is a hope that persists, I believe, in the midst of all of this. And in the midst of the worst of it, somehow the hope never quite gets stamped out. And I think that is a profoundly, an equally profoundly important human phenomenon that keeps us going, keeps, based on our conversation this morning, you and me going, and I suspect keeps us going at large, determined to try, learn the lessons, pick ourselves up, dust ourselves down, and keep going.
And the last thing I will ask, and then we'll go to the audience. We got the mic, a couple of mics, one mic, is I thought it would be unfair to you if you didn't get to talk a little about Teilhard and Faust, who both play a role in this argument.
Right, okay. Well, to keep it brief, because you may or may not all be interested in Teilhard de Chardin. Teilhard de Chardin was a French Jesuit priest, actually, writing in the before the war and then in the early parts of the post-war period. And he wrote in particular a book called The Phenomenon of Man. Sorry about the rather now sexist-sounding title. And the French have in the French, which he wrote, it was Le Phénomène Humain, and therefore he had a kind of gender-neutral title for it. And what it did was to look, and he was a paleontologist, so he starts way back in human development, and in a rather, he is not a clear writer, he's not an easy writer, but he tracks what he believes is a fundamental change in the human spirit that arises from the way in which humanity, from its early beginnings, probably in East Africa, spreads out around the world, meets itself ever more intensively, and gradually changes its nature as it does so, finding more and more of a unity. There's something very profound about the way he talks about globalization, and I am fascinated by it, partly because he is not naive. He explores that ambiguity that I've just mentioned. Does this all end in something like a New Jerusalem, or does it all end in a catastrophe? He explores that and doesn't get off the fence. So that's one thing I like. Faust is the great myth of Faust, the man who sells himself to the devil, is, I think, a very telling archetype of human experience, because it speaks so much to the condition of modern commercial man in so many ways. How many people can we think of who look as though they might have sold? How many people have felt the temptation to, in effect, sell themselves to the devil in return for ... In the original story, of course, he writes a contract with the devil which says, you can have my soul if for 24 years you allow me to do exactly what I want. Basically that simple. And that notion is explored in some wonderful literature, European literature, starting with Christopher Marlowe's famous play and ending in Goethe's magnificent literary work, Goethe's Faust, which is one of the great literary products of humankind. And it explores, and I could spend, you said you could spend 2 hours, I could easily spend 2 hours on this, so I'm not going to. The real point is, this is one way of describing the risk of compartmentalization. You, as it were, bow down to a lesser god. You say, this is what I am going to devote all of my being to, and you pay the price if you do. And you can see it in all kinds of literature. It's there in Macbeth. The phrase, the be-all and end-all, which is a phrase familiar to us all, comes from a passage in Macbeth where he's in effect saying, if I knew that with the murder of Duncan, I am going to get the kingdom and all else will be well in this life, he will, as he puts it in the phrase, if this could be the be-all and the end-all here, I'd jump the life to come. Now, that's a particularly explicit way of making the point. But the real point is we all do this, or we're all at risk of doing this in all sorts of subtle ways.
I was thinking that these days the contract with the devil would be in derivatives or credit default swaps, and the devil would end up with nothing at all. But who wants to ask the first question? Please, sir.
Well, you said we can't go back before globalism, but when globalism first started, I think the Western nations, especially the United States, thought that the model, at least those who or the prime examples of globalism would be capitalist like the United States and democratic like the United States. But yet we find today those are the very nations who are in most trouble. The nations that seem to be doing best on globalization are China, a status nation and a quasi-capitalist nation, and India, which is also a status nation. So do you think that the United States can ever recover its role in the world again from these nations? And if it doesn't, won't it have to leave globalization?
A number of points, if I may. First, you said globalism or globalization started within the life of the United States. I don't think it did. I think globalization started way, way, way before that. The modern momentum is clearly within the last 50 to 100 years. And you're right that some of the recent beneficiaries, some of the new arrivals on the world stage, are not representative democracies in the way that the US understands the term. India is, actually, since you mentioned too, of which India plainly is a representative democracy. You asked, can the US recover? I wasn't sure what you were looking for the US to recover. I do think there's an interesting point here, which is not necessarily a comfortable one to articulate in this side of the Atlantic, but I'll articulate it nevertheless. And that is that there have only been, I think I might slightly provocatively argue, there have only been two times in the whole of world history when there has been one global superpower. One of them was between 1815, with the demise of Napoleonic France, and in a way you want to care to end it, but I would suggest 1871 with the unification of Germany. So a brief 50-ish years of a global superpower based on the power of the Royal Navy. The second one started, you might want to argue, in 1989. We can all debate the starting and ending points. And I would suggest is we're kind of somewhere around the end now. This does not mean, of course, that global superpower is about to move off the world stage at all. This is going to be the biggest economy for some while to come. It's going to be the biggest military power for a long time to come. It's going to be a major player on the world stage for all of our lifetimes and that of our children and grandchildren, I would suggest. But I do think the world in general, and America in particular, is going to have to get used to the fact that there are going to be one or two other powers on the world stage. And I suppose one might then go on to say that to that extent, the world in international politics is going to feel a bit more like the tensions and stresses of Europe in the late 19th century than in the period of 1970s through to about now. Life's going to get more complicated. I don't think there's anything we can do about that.
Mr. Mitchell.
I'm venturing into dangerous territory. I recognize it.
Thank you. Gary Mitchell from the Mitchell Report. I want to. I noticed that the title of today's session was Money and Morality, and yet we ended up talking about banks, which, as Willie Sutton observed a very long time ago, was where the money is, and as we know today, it's a lot of other places too. I want to talk about an issue. I'd like to get your thinking about an issue that I think concerns a lot of people in this room and in the country at large, and that is money and morality as it relates to politics, and especially in light of the recent Supreme Court decision with which I presume you have some familiarity, Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission, which equates corporations with individuals. But the point is that there is a good bit of thinking in this country that money is doing great damage to the political system, and that as it becomes a larger factor, things get worse. And I'm wondering whether A, in the book, or B, in your own thinking, you've given much thought to money, morality, and politics.
I'm not an American citizen, and nor am I an expert on American politics, and I would feel slightly like I was entering into dangerous territory if I got too far into answering that question directly. EJ, you're in a much better position to talk about it than I am. I just want to make one more general point, and forgive me, it is a more general point, because I don't feel competent to talk about the issue of the financing of American political activity. And that is that money, what is the connection between money and, why is money in the subtitle? It is because money is kind of the essence of commercial life, and has become the essence of commercial life. And as a medium of exchange, you could argue, has the effect of changing the nature of relationships between individuals as they meet in the bazaar. And there's some very interesting writing from earlier in the last century, from around 100 years ago, by a particular sociologist who I do quote in the book by the name of Simmel, who's a German sociologist. He wrote a book called The Philosophy of Money, and in which he explores the way in which money changes relationships as a matter of philosophy, not as a matter of particular political institutional activity. It is written by a German sociologist 100 years ago, so it's slightly ponderous, it must be said. Nevertheless, I think it's on to something profound. And he goes as far as to explore the implications of money, which he regards as both important in its own right, but also as a symbol of urbanisation, and I think he's right to see it in that way, not only for the nature of relationships in commerce, but also for its effect on culture, its effect on art, its effect on self-understanding. And it's really quite interesting. And it's for that reason, apart from the obvious straightforward ones, that money appears alongside morality in the subtitle. But forgive me, on the specific question of the financing of American politics, I think I'd rather leave it to a real expert.
And I've written on this so much that no one wants to hear my views right now. Sir?
I have two short questions. Question one, to summarize the current economic crisis, obviously bankers took huge risks knowing they are too big to fail. And my question is, are governments able to prevent bankers from gambling with other people's money? Question one. Question two, in times where there is a huge supply of money in the world, what is the unit to measure wealth? Is it paper money? Is it gold? Should we get back to Bretton Woods? Or create a Bretton Woods too?
To the first point, which I feel much more competent to answer than the second one, I think there are ways of stopping bankers and other parts of the financial markets taking unreasonable risks and then turning to the taxpayer and asking to be bailed out. Yes, and I think the one way of looking at the last couple of years would be to say that last year, 2009, was a year of transition in the sense that the collective we stabilised the financial system, which was dangerously near to collapse in the first couple of 3 months of the year, and also that the real economy bottomed out. It looks as though almost everywhere the real economy bottomed out in by the end of last year. Even poor old Britain managed to kind of nudge up its growth rate in the fourth quarter. Not everywhere. Spain is still in recession. But it looks as though the corner's been turned. This year is the year when the lessons have not merely to be learnt, but explored and then a consensus reached on how to implement them. And they get awfully technical, and I don't want to, unless everybody does want me to, spend a lot of time on what they are. They are lessons about how you define bank capital, how much capital a bank should have held against what sorts of activity, lessons about leverage of banks, lessons about liquidity parameters within which banks operate, lessons about how you oversee other parts of the financial markets, and so on. And there's an immense amount of very detailed technical debate going on at the moment in the context led by the Financial Stability Board, which was a creation of the G20, and carried out at the technical level by groups of people in Basel under the aegis of the Bank of International Settlements. And if they adhere to the timetable, then by the end of this year, we will have internationally agreed parameters for the way in which the system is allowed to operate and banks within the system are allowed to operate, which I do believe will have learnt the essential lessons from the crisis and which will lead us to be able to say we have strengthened the financial system in a way that should prevent this crisis, anyway, recurring. I'm not so naive as to believe that that means we'll prevent all future crises occurring. There is something about the financial markets that is just prone to instability. But we can reduce the amount of that, and we can reduce the risk, and reduce the risk of the call on the taxpayer quite significantly. And that's the project for this year, at an international level. Very important. On the question of... what was the second one?
Bretton Woods too.
Bretton Woods and all that. Yeah. I can't believe that going back to the gold standard is possible. I just don't think it's in the realm of possibility. Or some form of orchestrated Bretton Woods, meaning where everybody agrees to pretty fixed currency relationships. Nor do I think that's particularly necessary. Actually, interestingly, if you think about the financial crisis, one market in which there was no crisis was the foreign exchange market. Remained liquid and smooth operating throughout. And currencies have moved around, the dollar's got a bit weaker, not in the last few weeks, admittedly, the euro's got weaker. But these are movements that are perfectly explicable in terms of the basic economic imperatives of the various economies concerned. So I don't think a return to Bretton Woods is actually what is called for at the moment. And indeed, at the present moment, you have an issue in the eurozone, of course, which is a form of mini Bretton Woods, because you've got one particular country which is in difficulty, and the whole question about how do we does that country get bailed out is very much in the headlines, at least that side of the Atlantic. And it reminds you of some of the pressures that did exist when Bretton Woods existed and why it eventually broke down, by the way.
Sir, since you're right there, and there's so many people, I want this lady afterward and then the gentleman there, and then I'll go to the back.
I was wondering, what role does democracy play in globalization? We have most corporations are controlled by oligarchies, I believe. I mean, the management system are not democratically elected. And nations like China are certainly oligarchies in controlling the economy. And the previous question related to corporations paying for campaign financing of elected representatives to the U.S. Congress, one wonders what they're beholden to these corporations also.
Well, as I said in response to the previous question, I don't feel competent to talk about the American political system, so forgive me. But to state the obvious, as EJ mentioned, I use a Churchillian defense of the markets. Well, I certainly think there's a Churchillian defense to be urged for democracy, i.e. it's the worst system except for all of the others that have been tried from time to time. And it will be messy. It's messy in this country. It's messy in my country. It's particularly messy in my country at the moment because they're in the throes of an unacknowledged general election campaign at the moment. And then there are countries in Asia that have different constitutions and different approaches. Who knows how those will evolve over time? I think before one assumes that all of Asia is non-democratic and in institutional structure, it is perhaps worth making two points. One is that even within a country like China, there is quite a lot of pluralism, and more than I think many people recognise in the way it actually operates in the country. And secondly, you have the world's largest and successful democracy sitting in Asia. This was a country that only a year ago went to the polls peacefully and fairly, and on the basis of 700 million votes, elected the government. I mean, let's celebrate that for what it was. For all all of my Indian friends would tear their hair out every now and then about the way the government actually carries on. That's no different from the way we in Britain tear our hair out about the way the British government carries on, and I suspect you may do so here. As to corporations and democracy, I think that's a slightly more complicated issue. I don't think it's true that corporations are run by oligarchies. At least it doesn't feel like it, sitting inside one. And of course it is the case that the directors are elected. The management isn't elected, but the directors are elected. And they're not elected, at least in the case of large public companies, by a small oligarchy of shareholders. They're elected by, in our case, 200,000 shareholders. Do they all cast their votes? No, no. Are some of those votes, are some of the votes wielded by a relatively small number of pension funds? Yes, they are. But it's not that small a number of pension funds, and they are operating on behalf of what we calculate in our case to be something like 17 million people. So I think to say, at least speaking for this particular institution that happens to pay me, it doesn't feel like it's an oligarchy kind of deliberately out to corrupt the workings of market economics globally. There clearly are many issues and many injustices, let it be said, many injustices in the way democracies work and non-democracies work. And the fight for justice will be with us to the rest for the rest of time, one way or another.
I was thinking corporations are about as democratic as the United States Senate, as you were describing that structure. Let me just press you on that. I want to bring this lady in. There was a line in the book I was looking for. I had arguments with the book in the margins. I don't know how you read books, but I scribble a lot in margins. There was a moment in the book where you talked about all kinds of good things that had happened, people getting pensions, people being able to purchase things, and you said these were the results of capitalism. And what I scribbled in the margin was, no, a lot of these things were the result of democracy, of organizing, of unions, of laws. In other words, it wasn't capitalism itself that spread these things around. Capitalism did produce wealth. But that the very things you were praising were the product of democratic decision, and that, again, it goes back to the problem of the global economy, is there is nothing comparable to a democratic structure, which is, and I just wanted you to comment on that.
I think that's a fair comment. It is clearly, in the case of pensions, for example, it was famously Bismarck who first created a national insurance system, not the big German combines of the time. So that's clearly right. I think it's also true, and you've said it, that it's within the context of capitalist activity that these products do get created and honed and improved and spread, and to make the obvious point too, and they're also often screwed up and missold and misconstructed and so forth. Like I say, at its best it does it wonderfully, at its worst it's terrible, but we have no real alternative to finding a way of working with the market to continue to develop and spread these benefits.
Ma'am.
Yes, my name is Sanjin Choi. I'm an aerospace analyst. First of all, I want to thank you for your splendid book. It was absolutely fabulous. First of all, it was very interesting because you avoided temptation to give offer any lectures or preaching in your book, but you focused on self-questioning, which is quite remarkable for 4 square miles for bankers. My question is that looking at the money and morality on certain words, and you, as a chairman of HSBC, has been one of the most profitable banks in the world, and perhaps partly due to having two Goldman Sachs bankers in your board, which is a very good start. And
ex-Goldman Sachs bankers.
Ex-Goldman. Do forgive me. Yes, Simon Robson and Mr. Sultan in here. And obviously, you have been a very successful as a banker. My question is related to the uncertain world, and Ms. Ije Dion talk about morality issues. You're already a member of the Prime Minister's Business Council for Britain, so you do play important role on unpaid basis. But my question
is unpaid, yeah.
My question is UK and regulatory regime issues. At the moment, and UK is, I guess, banking issues, Treasury, Bank of England, FSA, it's shared dealing with bank regulatory issues. Should Conservative win the election May 6th? And George Osborne is quite keen to change the structure. So my question is, in his view, perhaps it makes sense to strengthen Bank of England as supervisor law and create a CPA. And do you have any view? And B, should Mervyn King decide to retire before year 2013? And you would be an excellent person to this job. Would you be interested in this job?
Well, on that last point, I've got a day job which I'm enjoying doing. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
He didn't say no. I want to call everyone's attention.
This is a piece of. If you follow the British media, this is a piece of puff that has developed, and it is complete puff. But on the other point, the point about what is the right structure. I think the visitor from Mars could design different ways of setting up a regulatory structure. It is clear that you've got to have macroeconomic policy management that I think everywhere belongs with a central bank. You've got to have what, to use the current jargon, macroprudential regulation, meaning system stability and the stability of big institutions within the system. I think everybody would acknowledge that those two things have to sit quite closely together, the macroeconomic and the macroprudential. There are then all kinds of other regulatory issues, stretching all the way from the regulation of much smaller institutions and brokers and other kinds of entity, through to customer issues, how are products sold and marketed and those kinds of questions, and exactly how you divide up responsibility for all of these things is less important, in my view, than making sure that however you divide it up, you've got the right people doing it and talking to each other. Because you've got to have some kind of division of labour in doing this. This isn't just ducking your question, but I genuinely think there are different ways of setting it up, and the important thing is how do the different arms of this overall regulatory regime work together. In the case of Britain, I think all the regulators have acknowledged that certainly to begin with in the run-up to the crisis and in the early part of the crisis, they weren't doing as good a job as they could have at working together. I would testify, speaking as a regulatee, that has improved enormously, and I think the body politic works quite well in regulating the British environment at the moment. And I'm not going to comment on the US regulatory environment.
Susan, how much time do we have left? Because we have so many people.
We have about 10 minutes left.
What I'd like to do is bring in several people at once. Now, that does allow our speaker cleverly to dodge the questions he feels like it, but this is a very moral person, so he will try to take them on. So if I could go first on this side, this gentleman, that gentleman, and the gentleman in the back, if you could be brief so we could get you all in, then I will move over to this side. Thank you.
Yeah, is this? Yes. This is on behalf of my 16-year-old daughter, who is a faithful HSBC customer.
I hope we give her good service.
I promised it. She's done some work in microfinance in Vietnam recently and would like to pursue that as a career. Any thoughts you have on the future of micro-lending in very poor nations would be much appreciated.
He writes about that in the book.
She should send us her CV.
Yes, that was an excellent job application. I admire parents who do that.
Yeah, Charlton, freelance correspondent. They describe the U.S. As the Wall Street capitalism, and Europe is social capitalism. Since you are chairman of the Prime Minister Business Council for Britain, what's the kind of capitalism you think is right for Britain? And you talk about the priceless is a relationship, and since globalization, urbanization, people get together and the nation get close together. So in order for the stability of society and international relation, do you think humanity is very important and how to nurture that? Thank you.
Thank you. And then this gentleman right here with this the yellow shirt.
The one thing we've seen in recent decades is a tremendous rapid innovation in electronic technology, computers, and telecommunications. That's made it easier for bankers and others in finance to arbitrage existing regulations, sidestep the rules. Given that the technology is irreversible, what are your thoughts in terms of the extent to which there has to be a fundamental rethink of banking and financial regulation in a manner that relies less on detailed prescriptive rules and relies more on the incentives that are dangled in front of marketplace players?
That's a good question.
Why don't you take that package and then we'll go to the right side of the room.
Okay, well, micro-lending, I think, has an enormously important part to play, particularly in rural development, particularly in emerging markets. In our case, we sponsor and support micro-lending activities in a number of countries, India being the biggest example in our case. It's very hard for big institutions to do it. I think the difficulty about micro-lending is it's hard to scale. And therefore, it is of its nature something that is done by a lot of small units. And where the bigger institutions can play their part is in technical advice, capital support, and sometimes funding support, and sometimes personnel secondments even. But I think it's a very powerful device. It has very attractive characteristics. It reaches into rural areas. It empowers women, I'm sure anybody knows about microlending. It's kind of 90%+ women who are the clientele. It brings them into commercial life, into the mainstream, empowers them, and it has all sorts of ramifying positive effects. So I'm a huge believer in it. And if your daughter would like to send me the CV, she's welcome. on to the question at the back about, I think what you're asking for is a sense, which I do share, that if globalization continues in the way that I believe it will, and I think its failure to do so has some horrendous implications which we wouldn't really want to accept, so that if it does, it follows as night follows from day that we have to get to know each other better. And we have to understand our common humanity. And there are some positive things to build on in this. I mean, what is striking to me is how very widespread, though, the sense of understanding of what the values are for a successful business relationship are. How very universal those values are. This is not a case, in my view, that cultures have such fundamentally different approaches to values and what it is to be human, that we're bound to clash with each other. I'm a fundamental disbeliever in the clash of civilizations thesis. And there are risks of it, for sure, but as that is the likely outcome, that is the thing that we should mainly prepare for, I fundamentally reject as a thesis. On the contrary, I believe, my own personal testimony, and I do have the privilege of having travelled to a lot of different countries and lived in some, the more you get to know each other, the more you discover the commonality, the more you enrich your own experience, the more you understand each other's, not merely business practices, but their art and culture and so forth, the more enriching it is. So I think there's that's why at the end of the day if not an optimist, at least not a naive optimist, I'm at any rate somebody who believes in the power of hope. And then to the last question on regulation and how you do that, and that's an awfully... we could spend 3 hours on it. I don't think it's enough, given all that we've experienced, to say it is just a matter of articulating some principles and then hoping people will live within incentives to comply with the principles. I think it is inevitable that regulation will become more intrusive than that. The fundamentally important point, in my view, is that the regulatory development has to be done internationally. The financial markets are firstly not compartmentalizable into banks versus rest. I mean, it's like a balloon. If you pinch one end of the balloon, the air just goes up to the other end. And secondly, they're borderless. If you control it in one country, it will migrate to somewhere else. So international court, it calls for all that we can summon up in terms of international coordination. And there are risks to that. There are risks at the moment to this as different countries come up with their different proposals. It takes a bold person to be encouraged by the current state of that, and yet we have no alternative but to proceed. What I do think is interesting, just to step back from the specifics of regulation for 1 second, is the emergence of the G20. If there was ever a sign institutionally at the moment of what I was saying earlier about the way in which the lineup of political power on the world stage is shifting, it's the arrival of the G20 and the marginalisation of the G7. Quite appropriately, it seems to me, you can't solve the world's problems, not just financial and economic, but also environmental, climate change, etc., without taking onto the world stage, accepting on the world stage, countries like China, India, Brazil, Saudi Arabia, etc. You don't have to pretend that everybody has the same constitutional arrangements. You don't have to admire all aspects of each other's country, obviously, yet we do have to recognise the fact that we can't solve these problems other than by reaching, and often painfully reaching, the accords in that kind of forum.
And then we'll go to this side. As Stephen talked, I reminded me of an old friend who was far less hopeful than he was about dialogue. This friend said, sometimes when people really get to know each other, they come truly to understand why they hated each other in the first place. But that's not it. Oh, this lady right there.
Tom Lehrer kind of comment.
Hi, thank you for being here. My question is, HSBC is known for frowning on high pay for its executives. You've been quoted calling bankers' pay distorted and inflated. EJ also touched on this earlier. But today, HSBC is making headlines for the proposed pay increases for 2010 for its executives. And I just wanted to get your stance on this.
Well, I think the only thing I can usefully say on that is we have not said anything publicly. We haven't made any announcements. We do our results on Monday week. That is the point at which there's various speculation around at the moment, which I wouldn't want to comment on. My general comment stands that the market in the labor market, if you will, in the banking world has been distorted when you look backwards. I think there are ways of getting that right. I think the principles articulated by the G20, just to go back to that for a second, and specifically in the case of the UK, the FSA code, which is now mandatory on the banks, which forces not quantum limits, but structures of pay that align the pay with the risk and therefore with the real interest of shareholders and the real interest of the taxpayer. As that beds down, I believe, you will have markets in which we can be more confident that proper pay is being given for proper performance. That is something you could not have been confident in looking backwards.
I would support you if you wanted to hound him further, but I don't think he's going to go anywhere on that question. Sir, these three folks here, the gentleman, let's do all three of you. The gentleman with the beard, if you don't mind my describing you that way.
A number of ecologists or environmentalists are beginning to talk about the impossibility of the economy continuing to grow, at least as far as natural resources are concerned. The indefinite expansion just is not a possibility. And yet, as I understand it, I'm not an economist, but as I understand it, expansion, growth in the economy is necessary for capitalism to exist. So I'd like your comment on that. The second thing that's related is, although you've talked about regulation, I haven't heard the word government as far as I know. And the question is, in terms of specifically environmental problems and the problem of externalization of costs, what's the role of government in approaching, in moderating the market so it can work with those problems?
And then two more, this gentleman on the aisle and then this gentleman over here.
I'd like to question the assumption that we all are resentful of the huge pay differentials in the world today, because we're not of all of them. For example, movie stars, pop stars, sports figures make huge differential. Nobody begrudges them that one bit. Even if they don't like their product, they don't, because they can't exclude people from the market and they don't get government bailouts. Now we're getting to the compensation of people in the Goldman Sachs and other finance capital. Isn't that really the problem, that the government has its hands, its thumbs, all over the scales of the market, the housing market to begin with, but also in the bailouts themselves? And people refer to this in the economics literature as moral hazard, that if you bail people out and subsidize risk, you're going to get a lot more of it and the destructive consequences. But that's a utilitarian analysis, but I think there's also a moral analysis of moral hazard, that it is just simply wrong for innocent people to have to pay for other people's mistakes.
I just, for the record, I resent all kinds of pay differentials myself, but you're a good libertarian for the way you ask that question, sir.
Here in the States, of course, socialism is a very evil word, with the exception of Vermont. But and also the idea of the welfare state is in Europe is just all kinds of commentary about why that's really incompatible with capitalism or market. It's just a mess over there in Europe. Although we've had our record of New Deal and economic schools out of progressivism, but the question I have is about sort of what kind of capitalism, what differences it make in terms of globalization as to what kind of capitalism there is, to what extent does a kind of coexistence of democratic socialism and capitalism produce benefits, to what extent does it put a drag on the benefits that you were talking about.
And could I ask a last question? Whenever I hear comments...
You're keeping a list of these questions.
I usually write them down, but I was thinking... I always feel like making a case for democratic socialism when somebody asks that kind of question. But anyway, my question is, in a funny way, the flip side of that, which is we know that no economic freedom produces tyranny. That is to say, no, if government controls all of the resources everyone has. On the other hand, it is not at all clear that economic freedom produces other sorts of freedom, political freedom. We now have seen that a certain kind of capitalism can coexist with rather vicious dictatorships. And I just want you to comment on that side of the question, too.
Well, to begin, you'll have to help me if I miss out. On the question of growth first, I don't know whether growth is necessary for capitalism, nor do I think that growth is necessary for the rest of time. And clearly you're right that at some point, even if we keep on postponing that point, an economy as currently conceived runs out of the resources to power it. The big imperative for the world at large at the moment is indeed to move to particularly to low carbon growth models. Actually, I'm not an expert on this, but all that I see suggests that actually quite considerable progress will get made over the next 10 to 20 years and needs to get made if we aren't to continue to inject more and more carbon emissions into the atmosphere with the deleterious effects that I believe that does have. I realise that some people question it, but I believe the evidence is reasonably compelling. What is the role of government? The government's essential to this, that you've got a problem of the commons with carbon emissions at the moment. There is no proper pricing. This is a good which obviously has a cost but not a price, which is another variant of the thing we were talking about earlier, things that have costs but don't have prices, and therefore too much of it is being produced, and we've got to get out of that cycle. And the only player in the social setup that can impose that cost is precisely government. Now, in the next breath, you've got to say, and it's international governments that have to do it. Again, it's a classic problem. This not merely a problem of the commons, but a problem that's an international problem of the commons, which forces us to recognise that we've got to work together. As that happens, and assuming that does happen over the next 2 to 3 to 4 years, that we get proper pricing of carbon, then I am confident enough that the ingenuity of the markets will lead to the unleashing of the appropriate technology, the development of the appropriate technology, the financing of the appropriate technology to bring growth towards a low-carbon format, which we'll be a lot more comfortable with. One thing for sure is that at global level, we cannot do without the growth. It's all very well for us in relatively wealthy America or Britain to say we could go to a no-growth economy. But actually, if you are in Africa or India or China, you can't afford to say that because there are people living in abject poverty in their hundreds of millions, indeed billions, in those countries. And what we take for granted is beyond the wildest hopes of so many people. So we have to continue to go for growth. It has to be low carbon if we're to protect the planet for our grandchildren. I've forgotten what the next question was.
Does the resentment at the differentials come from the bailouts?
Plainly, it is definitely aggravated by that. And that is to do with the distortions that I was referring to. I don't know about resentments of other kinds of compensation. At least in my country, there is quite a lot of resentment of the pay of, for example, senior entertainment figures in the public television channels. It's attracting a lot of attention at the moment. So it isn't just the bankers. But nevertheless, there's no doubt where the fire is primarily concentrated. And it is understandable why. I guess I said earlier what I believe to be the case. I believe there's a job of work to be done to make the market more effective. You will not, at the end of the day, have egalitarianism, and that leaves individual challenges that need to be faced up to by the individuals. But clearly, the distortions in the market, including the fact that the institutions concerned could then turn to the taxpayer for bailout after the individuals concerned have walked off with their millions, is part of the source of real public anger, no question. And then the question on democratic socialism.
Or what kind of capitalism, I think it was, is it fair to say, and then we'll close with this, skip my question.
Yeah. The evidence is, looking backwards, that capitalism can coexist with different forms of government, including some understandings of what communism might mean. I'm not sure it really can, but there are certainly countries around the world that still refer to themselves as communist, but are not in any original meaning of that word, communist, but are plainly not representative democracies. Secondly, it can coexist with fascism. We've seen that in previous decades. And thirdly, it does seem to be the obvious economic form that goes with representative democracy. There aren't many cases where it's lasted for very long that a representative democracy has voted in a fundamentally non-capitalist form of economy. It existed for a little bit in Europe after the war, for rather specific reasons, I would suggest. I think a better assumption is that normally the norm will be the market capitalism, not unregulated. I mean, I hope that everything I've said has added up to it being clear that I believe that capitalism has to be regulated by government stroke regulators, but that is the normal form of economic activity that will coexist with representative democracy. As to the final question in that, as to whether representative democracy will or will not become a universal human experience, Well, that's another question, as they say.
I want to make 2 points in closing. First, on the adjectives question, I was interviewing a Communist Party spokesman in Italy, and they had just put out their economic program. And not anywhere in the program was there an attack on capitalism. And I asked this spokesperson for the party, you know, I didn't see any attacks on capitalism. And he said, well, you cannot talk about capitalism anymore without adjectives. And that's when I thought we're all capitalists now.
Can I just interject one very quick thought? You mentioned welfare state, the welfare state issues in Europe. One thing is for sure, and I can say this living that side of the Atlantic, is that there is a fair degree, there's clearly a difference of central gravity in thought this side of the Atlantic from that side of the Atlantic about those sets of issues. And when you talk amongst Europeans, whether they're British or continental, about the debate that has gone on in this country about healthcare, there's a widespread bemusement. Now, I'm well aware of what gets said this side about the arrangements there, and maybe this is just one evidence of how far we are yet from a uniform world, even amongst developed countries.
There's actually widespread bemusement about our healthcare system here. And one of my favorite moments in Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech is when he quotes the prophet Amos and says, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I never expected to read a book by a banker that likes that very same line from Amos and quotes it in his book, which means that Stephen Green is not your typical banker. He's not your typical Anglican priest. And that makes his book and him and Stephen Green himself very interesting. And we thank you for your book and for being with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.